Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold. This is episode 3, covering the first issue of February. I'm Andrew Schoenfeld. I don't buy into the hype. I'm in the studio lately.
I'm Antonia Chen, and I'm sitting in my dining room.
We're bringing you the best of scientific research in JBJS every 2 weeks. I hope everyone has had a chance to listen to the first 2 episodes. If you haven't, head on back and check those out as well. Also, make sure that you are subscribing or following or going to jbjs.org and accessing the podcast from there. Orthopedics is sports, and sports is, I want to give a shout out to my man, Craig Speedy Claxton, head coach of the Hofstra men's basketball team. His first year after like 10 years in the NBA, and they just beat a nationally ranked Arkansas team. So he's doing great things there. Speedy and I go back to high school days. We played basketball together on a team that was number 2 in the nation in our senior year. 3 guys, including him from that team, played in the NBA, and I'm just doing this.
But this podcast is a slam dunk. So
You know it. So we got all sorts of intersections. And when it comes down to it, people are like, oh, your Cases on Hold podcast is being run out of Harvard. No, actually, mentally, I'm in Queens. And Antonia, you're from Jersey. So this is actually Tri-State Illuminati that's running this. This is not Skull and Bones. It's Tri-State Illuminati. And don't write to JBJS and say that, JBJS is run by the Illuminati, because I know that you're out there may be inclined to do such thing. So as per previous, this episode of Your Cases on Hold is brought to you by the Miller Review Course, internationally known and recognized from the state capital to the nation's capital, from the Big Apple to the Pineapple, for getting you the information you need to know for step 1 or part 1 of the ABOS board examination, and a great refresher for those at any stage in training who want to get some insights from some dynamite faculty. Just a disclaimer, the opinions here, and there will be some real opinions in this episode, the opinions here are mine and Antonia's and not reflective of the JBJS Board of Trustees, the editor-in-chief, the other deputy editors at the journal, or any of the subsidiary JBJS publications. We've got a good one. I am psyched for this episode. We've got instrumental variables in variations in care in spine surgery. We've got sex differences in end-stage ankle arthritis. We've got return of the Sith in the form of machine learning for Your Cases on Hold featurette. I think we need to get into it. Let's start with the headlines. Mine is discretionary care associated with safety among Medicare beneficiaries undergoing spine surgery? This is by Co and colleagues. There is an associated commentary for this. So if you don't believe what I have to tell you about it, you can see what other people are saying by reading this article on the website or in your issue of the journal, and also checking out the commentary. So this is about discretionary care. It's about practice-based variation. And it's very well done using Medicare claims from 2013 to 2017. This follows in a series of work that extends back almost 40 years, if you can believe it, to Jack Wenberg at Dartmouth. And Dartmouth is the coaching tree from which all this comes. Well, I think we might get to coaching trees later on too. But in this context, Jack Wenberg, 1987, conducts the initial investigations around practice-based variation, actually on appendectomy. And then that went into an entire thing at Dartmouth that was then followed by Jim Weinstein. And then the senior author on this project, Brooke Martin, he also was previously at Dartmouth. Now he's at Utah. And this also intersects with work that I've done with another Dartmouth-trained individual, John Berkmeyer, when I was at Michigan, and then also practice-based variation in Medicare. And that's also in the provider-induced demand context. So this is just a next step in a series of work that we've been working on for a long time. Look me up. PubMed me, Brittany. Brittany? Brittany? Anyhow, 2013 to 2018, they're looking at use of end-of-life care as an instrumental variable for dissecting whether differences in cost in terms of common spine surgical interventions are due to variations in price, variations in disease severity. And this is incredibly important to understand. There's some great heat maps that you can look at on a county level where the high cost areas are and where lower cost areas are. For the same type of procedures that are analyzed according to Medicare DRG groups. So not especially granular, and that is, you know, one of sort of the shortcomings, but that's the nature of Medicare data, of course. Ultimately, we find large degrees of variation, check this out, for thoracic or lumbar fusion, a low of about 38,000 in Meridian, Mississippi, to 121,000 in the Bronx. It always comes back to NYC. For cervical fusion, in Meridian, Mississippi, similarly 33,000. In Santa Cruz, California, just under $100,000. These are wide variation in costs that are impacting the healthcare system. And the study has shown that through the use of the instrumental variable of end-of-life care, that these are not due to differences in morbidities or differences in the difficulties in the type of case, because the use of an instrumental variable is essentially accounting for the random nature of those parameters. This is showing that it's really intentional. It's to some degree provider-induced, other, it's kind of culture and practice-based. But these findings are incredibly important. And another important point that I think is more broadly applied to the general audience is that the phenomenon of wide variation in discretionary care and orthopedics, it goes well beyond spine surgery. It has been identified in other specialties, sports, joint arthroplasty, fracture care, and the end-of-life instrumental variable could be assessed in those areas. And that's a pointer for those hungry individuals who've got that research eye of the tiger. We're gonna get you into that rock. We're gonna get you back to the gym with the blood and the sweat and the tears around you. So there are extra studies. Now it's not just we're doing the journal clubs. We're talking to you about research you can be doing. So this is readily actionable research in these other areas of orthopedics for which this type of instrumental analysis can be applied. It's really good work. It's methodologically sound. And I'd actually be interested in seeing, and I think there's room and appetite for similar research to be done in those other aspects of orthopedic surgery. What have you got?
So because you're my host, I can't put this case on hold. No, just kidding. I could put it on hold, but it's actually very good. It's exactly what you're saying, right? Spending doesn't mean better outcomes, right? If you think about stuff, you go, I spend more money, I get better quality, but that's not always the case, right? So I think this should be done in joints. I think it should be done across the board in all different areas. And it's their methodology, as you can imagine, is very in-depth and very detailed. And, you know, we'd probably just have to consult you to do all the other different ones as well, too. But there's a lot to learn from this. And I think the really interesting thing is that a lot of times we blame comorbidities. We always say, well, the patient's sick, that's why expensive. And that's why we need to do risk adjustment. And there's some truth to that, but that's not the only cost driver. So this is eye-opening to me. You know, in our world of optimization, we talked about that last time. We want to optimize our patients for a host of different reasons, but that's not the only reason why we should be doing that to reduce costs, because it's not the only variable.
Perfect. We're well aligned here.
We are well aligned, not putting that on hold. And I also find this next one, we're going to talk about sex differences in end-stage ankle arthritis following total ankle replacement or ankle orthodesis, linking dot et al., and it is free for 30 days. So the fundamental question they wanted to ask is something like they do in most of the world. We do it in arthroplasty first, and then other people take it from us. So we looked at hip and knee replacements, and they say, do males and females do differently after total ankle replacement or ankle arthrodesis? And it was a nice size database with thorough follow-up because the single payer system in Canada. So that's actually nice in terms of continuity of care. The nice thing, they also did a mix of different implants and different orthodontic techniques. But it was interesting that this company was actually funded by two different companies that make total ankle arthroplasty replacements. Now, it's better than just doing one company because there's multiple different implants. But it was a little surprising to see sponsorship for a total ankle, you know, for an ankle arthrodesis comparative study. One of the things that didn't sit great with me that I didn't love is that they said sex differences in end-stage ankle arthritis. But then when they did the methods, patients self-identified gender as male or female. So gender would probably be the right term. I would say there was no other options for identification either. It was male or female, nothing else. So it wasn't biological sex. So I thought it'd be gender would be more appropriate. But that said, it was interesting that even though this is a funded study by total ankle arthroplasty companies, those that underwent ankle arthrodesis had higher SF36 physical component scores than total ankle replacements. And they were also more satisfied than they were expected than the total ankle replacement cohort. So the mental aspect of that was the other side. It was higher for total ankle replacement than ankle arthrodesis. But this was not true when they controlled for inflammatory arthritis, which was higher in the female population. My other take-home message for me personally is that females had greater preoperative pain and lower postoperative pain, meaning we do have higher pain tolerance. Thankfully, we do because we're the ones who have babies in the world and lower postoperative pain. But at the end of the day, the authors are very real and very, to the point, basically said sex didn't make a huge difference across the board, either for total ankle replacement or total ankle arthrodesis. So they're pretty similar differences between males and females, noting that there wasn't big differences. There were statistical differences, but not truly clinical differences. So at the end of the day, they both do well. They both improve. One is more likely to, you know, in this population of patients, they did more total ankle replacements. In some other populations, it might be more ankle arthrodesis. But at the end of the day, the take-home message is mostly that there's not a huge difference between males and females.
Yeah, it is free for 30 days. So no excuses out there. Everybody should be checking this one out. You don't think it's suspect when it's funded by industry? It's good for everyone. They don't want to cut out 50% of the market share, right?
Give it to all. The more the merrier, right?
Not for real, though. For real. You don't think it's a little sus when it's industry funded like that?
Well, I always find it. Anytime it's anything industry funded is always a little suspected, right? The interesting thing is why only those two companies? If they're going to include, let's say, those different, like 10 different implants, then get everyone to do so. And the ankle arthrodesis company who creates a nail, you know, for example. Then there's technically no conflict of interest if everyone's on board, or better yet, no one's on board. And you do this as a general, I mean, this is a database study, right? So this is something that can be pooled that probably, you know, we all need funding for research assistance and things like that, but better off coming to a conclusion without funding.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
So that one put it a little bit on hold, but still interesting. Okay.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, at the end of the day, no matter what we're saying, and I think this is especially, maybe it's a little bit of a disclaimer because I know it's coming, but it's not about, oh, this shouldn't have been published or it should have been published. I mean, all of this is methodologically sound. It's important. It's interesting. It's at the forefront, or it wouldn't be here. So, I mean, that part goes without saying. And then, like we said on the first episode, sometimes the takes are hot and it's done because we want people to get in and look at these things and decide for yourself. I mean, no matter what we're saying, you read it and you decide. The power is in your hands.
And give us feedback. Let us know if you disagree. We'd love to hear it because that's what science is all about.
That's the truth. And I think we're going to be hearing more about science and the scientific method in just a little bit as we get into Your Case is on Hold, where we get into the octagon of lexicon.
The black box has returned.
On multiple levels.
So
this is development and internal validation of machine learning algorithms to predict hyponatremia after total joint arthroplasty by Kunz and colleagues. What do you think?
So I wrote in big letters, big, big black box. And really, what's the take-home message? If your sodium is low before surgery, you're likely to have low sodium after surgery. Is that life-shattering? Dr. Schoenfeld?
I don't know. You'd have to answer that from a clinical standpoint because you are doing the joint arthroplasty. I have a number of thoughts on here, and I'm happy to jump in and then have you circle back. machine learning, like we discussed in the last episode, is increasingly used as sort of a stand-in for a statistical analysis. And in this case, they're using machine learning as a model to unpack factors associated with hyponatremia after total joint arthroplasty. And then they develop a clinical utility that is accessible or downloadable from the internet, and they want you to download it and use it. In the today's day and age, where we have fill out the prompts with the patient, fill out the shared decision-making algorithm with the patient, look at the patient's infection risks. Now you're also going to have a separate algorithm for hyponatremia. It comes from the Hospital for Special Surgery. It's unique to the Hospital Special Surgery, so it's only their patients that they're considering. They do have close to 31,000 patients, of whom close to 20% developed hyponatremia. But hyponatremia is a spectrum. It's anything less than 135 as they defined it. But then there's 134, and then there's 24, like, or 14, or anywhere in between. And they go through all the steps of the machine learning algorithm. They have the testing cohort and then the validation cohort. It follows best practices. There's no questions around that. But at the end of the day, they do fall into kind of the standard talking points, which is, this is machine learning, so it's extra special and it answers all our questions. And the dirty secret, actually, is this is science. So in science, you're trying to get to the truth. And in an epistemological sense, if what you know is true, either through empiric observation or through some type of experiment, you should get the same answer every time. So if you have a well-adjusted regression analysis, if you have a well-conducted propensity score matching analysis, if you have a machine learning analysis that takes you through all the relevant points, you should get the same answer from all three. It isn't, oh, the machine learning is showing you something different. And by the way, it isn't, as you pointed out, right? The risk factors that they identified through their machine learning algorithm are essentially the same thing that you have that's already existed in the literature. And they say, oh, but those studies are small and those studies are confounded and those studies, okay, but they found the same thing that you found. So, you know, at the end of the day, in the courses that I teach on methodology at the School of Public Health, we talk about the levels of evidence in the context of Plato's cave in the Republic. And let's just be honest out there for a second. If we weren't talking about levels of evidence using the metaphor of Plato's cave, I know that you guys out there would be disappointed. So
always Plato has to make
cheat code walked into your greatness. Plato's cave, though, is a very useful analogy in this context. You guys might have to go back to like philosophy 101 in your college days. But essentially, the idea is that there are individuals who are like trapped in a cave and they can't see the light of day. They can't see the actual sun and they can't experience the environment outside of the cave. So they only see things walking in front of the cave. They see shadows on the wall and they can't see the light for what it is. They're only seeing sort of variations. And that's really what scientific research is. The light is the perfect truth, which you don't ever get to, even with a randomized controlled trial. As you're going from level one to level two to level three to level four evidence, you're getting further and further away from the light and you're just getting closer to like the darkness. So what is this graded? It's graded level four, and it's graded level four appropriately. I think at the end of the day, this tool probably is good at predicting hyponatremia if you want to do that in the context of the population serviced by the Hospital for Special Surgery. That may not be reflective of the population in your practice. Look at their table one. They have very low numbers of patients with actual hypertension. They don't do a socioeconomic assessment, but I suspect that there's some socioeconomic factors at play as well. So if you're interested in applying this to your practice, I think you have to consider how well your practice mirrors that at HSS. If you are at HSS and using it, it'll probably be good. If you're somewhere else, maybe less so.
But if you apply it to your patients who are HSS, they were probably already in the initial set, so it can't even be used for external validation. So does it actually work?
Right. Well, I mean, and that's the other thing about it. It's a great point that you bring up. These studies will do, they'll tell you it's validated because they took 20% of the initial cohort, which, oh, by the way, are the exact same patients treated the exact same way with the exact same risk factors. And they say, see, it works. And that's kind of sort of a vaudeville sleight of hand, I think. It's not really validated until you've taken this and applied it prospectively in a separate cohort of patients that, oh, by the way, has the complete spectrum of that can exist in the clinical variation with enough numbers to account for intersection and confounding. And until that's done, it's not really validated.
Correct. And then, as you said, to your point, like BMI 26, like I don't see those that often because my patients aren't as pretty as they are at HSS. So that's just something different that can I apply this to me? And if I do apply it to my patients, will it make a difference? You know, am I going to treat my patients any differently if they are likely to be hyponatremic postoperatively? I'm still going to wait till they become hyponatremic postoperatively and then treat their hyponatremia either by increasing their sodium or restricting their fluid. So either way, my treatment algorithm from a practical perspective probably won't change a great deal.
Yeah, a sneak peek cheat code right here for the aspiring researcher. With a lot of these studies, you get the comment where they say this can be used in preoperative discussions and risk adjustment. And that may be true. It's kind of a throwaway statement. Going forward, I think it's going to be harder. I'm not speaking to JBJS. This is not because I have control of what gets in and what doesn't. I do not. But I think it's going to be harder and harder at higher tier journals for you to say something like that as your conclusion and for people to just accept it at face value, because people are seeing a lot of these and I think they're starting to understand, okay, like there can't be a machine learning algorithm for every single possible outcome that's adverse. Machine learning for ESRD, machine learning for transfusion, machine learning for UTI, machine learning for intubation, machine learning for myocardial infarction, like. But, and then not just after every single type of outcome, but every single type of surgery, ACDF, lumbar fusion, ankle fracture, bunion. Like.
And when's the last time a patient asked you about their sodium level?
Probably never.
So, you know, to your point, like maybe the bigger ones, such as like intubation or readmissions or ER visits are a little more clinically applicable, but hyponatremia, now this is a good first start to get to ideas, right? But not as applicable, I'd say, at this time point.
And the biggest final nail for me is that the preachers of machine learning are like, the machine is going to tell you stuff that you don't know.
Dun, dun, dun.
You're going to learn stuff that you didn't even know. You're going to get red pilled. But they do the machine learning. And at the end of the day, this tells us exactly the same thing that the last study on this told us.
So you think you're getting a mind-blowing set of knowledge into another universe and you're already doing it. Thank you, Matrix. They're not controlling our minds, I hope. All right.
All right. So
this is on hold.
Yes.
All right.
Indubitably. Toss up. Next stop. Now that we know the acetabular safe zone, where do we go? This is on redefining the 3D topography of the acetabular safe zone, a multivariable study from Hevesy and colleagues.
So as a total joint surgeon, I'm very happy to see this because everyone says, you guys don't change at all. You guys are still debating the same problems you've had for decades and you guys never change everything. And if you think about Lewinic safe zone, that has been there for ages, right? So this is a study and they're not the first study to question the Lewinic safe zone because a lot of studies have shown, hey, look, these patients dislocated even they were in the Lewinic safe zone. And then also look at a lot of patients outside who are outside the Lewinic safe zone haven't dislocated. So this is probably something that needs to be addressed and updated for a long period of time. So this study assessed the famous Lewinic safe zone and kind of defined what parameters are actually safe. Back to the idea of machine learning, artificial intelligence is another term that we use all the time. So they use artificial intelligence to read x-rays, which basically meant they took x-rays, they did exactly what we normally do in measuring acetabular inclination and animadversion. And I used to use a different software for it. They use a certain software here. They use two surgeons and they said, oh, by the way, it works. But it sounds fancier and more sophisticated if you say artificial intelligence. So they read it and they basically said, we want to know if whether or not the safe zone should be changed based on different approaches. Interestingly enough, in this methods, though, they did not state how they defined dislocation. So one of those things, the dislocation, is it from in medical record? Are they getting it from patients who, you know, if they dislocate in the emergency room, we're not coding it, the ER is coding it. Are they capturing those patients? They go to another hospital system, are they capturing it? So these are probably dislocations that are treated, whatever reason they've noted it in the notes and the post-operative notes, if they come see you in clinic, or they're reduced in the emergent, in the operating room, or we have to undergo some sort of revision. So I wish they had defined that. And then they also included dislocation as post-op day zero. So, you know, is this a dislocation or is this, you know, something else that's happened, or, you know, the spinal's still working and, you know, the muscle tone is bad, although it still should not dislocate. They included, they didn't have a time frame there. So they did show that there was a different zone that they would recommend. So they said, you know, the typical, you know, is 15 and 25 degrees of antiversion and 30 and 50 degrees of abduction. So they said there's a new modern safe zone of 27 to 47 abduction and 18 to 30 of antiversion. Now, a question that some people might ask is, how much do that 1 or 2 or 3 degrees actually make a difference? Does that clinically make a difference? Now, there are impingement models based on this now and robotics and stuff that look at it, but does it make a huge difference? And in the context of this study, my questions are, for example, when it comes to the outcome, and this is obviously only a certain area and a certain number of patients and a certain number of surgeons, while a big number, it is a certain geographical area. In this study, the anterior lateral approach had a higher dislocation rate than DA, which was surprising. Most other studies show the opposite. So that sounds causing things a little bit of question. It could be the batch of patients, to our point about machine learning. Who are you studying and what are you putting it out on? You know, these patients, if you look at the tables, had higher abduction cup angles than they did in DA and PL, which is not always the case for direct lateral. So that's one question there is, you know, is that what's making the difference, not the approach that's making a difference. And then antiversion for direct anterior wasn't the highest. It was actually highest in posterior lateral, which is most studies have shown the opposite. Anterior shows the highest rate of antiversion. So this patient population is very specific and the findings may be specific to this patient population. So do you want to take this number and put it in your own practice? Hard to say. It'd be nice to be able to take this methodology and study your patients. So this may not be across the zone the best answer, but it's not a huge, huge difference from a Lewinic safe zone. The last thing is that, interestingly, being male is protective of dislocation, but males had a steeper penalty for non-optimal abduction. So it's protective, but be really careful when you're doing so. So when you're doing males, that's something to think about. So what do I think about the study? I think it's good to revisit this. I think we always need to go back and say, are our practices still what we're doing today based on historical values true? And the answer is, in this case, no, it's a little bit different. So there are this group and this, you know, guidelines would say, okay, I'm going to change what I practice and what I'm doing to better suit my patients to decrease dislocation rate. But there are a few methodological things I would probably change or at least address and then say, this may be good in their population, but maybe not your patient population.
Yeah, I think that you mentioned several points that I thought as well. I think we're very well aligned here. Let me ask you, you know, the statement that they make that really stood out to me is the surgical approach and patient sex demonstrated clear effects on the 3D safe zone topography. And you brought up some of those issues that sort of lack some face validity. So maybe parochial or just restricted to this cohort's experience rather than being generalizable. The statement in and of itself stood out to me. I was like, yeah, this is probably the real take home message. But then hearing what you're saying, it's like, well, hold on. That case may be on hold.
A little bit. Maybe the term clearly is on hold. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be as assertive to go to the point of clearly or obviously and things like that. But there are signs that show that it does demonstrate in this patient population that that's the case.
Okay.
All right. Time to toss it up back to you. Ready?
Yes.
Tell me about post-acute care costs following total hip arthroplasty over the last decade are doing what?
They are not generalizable. That's my Mad Lib for that. This is post-acute care costs following total hip arthroplasty in the paper National Trends in Post-Acute Care Costs Following Total Hip Arthroplasty from 2010 to 2018. This is by Serino and colleagues. Again, free for 30 days, so no excuses. You all need to get in here and decide whether it's on hold or not. But I'll give you my take on it. This study was done using data from Pearl Diver, which is one of these large registries that pulls claims data from a variety of sectors. They develop cost estimates over the course of the episode of care costs, post-acute care costs, and, you know, savings, long story short, getting better with time. The most interesting association I think that they make is that the post-acute care costs declined most rapidly after the introduction of new Medicare bundled payment programs in 2013 and 2016. I think that's a separate parallel signal for the power and impact of these kinds of capitated programs. Beyond that, though, the first issue is that while the sample could be considered national in terms of its scope and reach, it's not nationally representative. And overwhelmingly, Pearl Diver data, and you can look at this in their tables or tables from other data sources that go into it in even more explicit detail, tend to be privately insured or like Medicare Part C data elements. So you're missing certain part of the population, particularly those who are disadvantaged socioeconomically or underinsured. There's also potential for restricted clinical and practice-based variation, even though they do capture a lot of patients. And the biggest issue here with all of these types of studies is it's 2010 to 2018. Here we are in 2022. All of these studies particularly, I think, are impacted by the reality of the COVID crucible through which we are all currently passing is accelerating, decelerating, and altering practice patterns. So again, a statement from our methodology classes at the School of Public Health, past performance does not predict future outcomes. Past performance is just past performance. It doesn't inform any future trends for sure. A lot of times these kinds of prognostications are not linear. So it's like, oh, we're seeing this and it'll just keep going on the path that it was previously. That's how you get to these estimations that like 3 billion people are going to have hip replacement in the United States by 2050. Oh, by the way, there won't be 3 billion people in the United States at that time. They're not linear. And so, you know, what you're seeing here, like it's for the time period under study, it is what it is. I think the interesting associations are more around the bundled payment piece and what it means going forward. You have to decide that for yourself. Choose your own adventure. Get in there and read it.
And the adventure that we've chosen, which was to reduce costs, is that we did it. That's really all I could get from this, right? To say, hey, look, we actually were told to do so and we did it. And how we did it is something that's been published by multiple different studies saying we reduced post-acute care and that's how we reduced our episode of care. You know, and total joint surgeon, you know, we're going to go back to Oprah. You know, you get a nursing home, you get a rehab facility. Everyone gets one because everyone would come and being like, well, my aunt Maida, who had a hip replacement 20 years ago, went into rehab for 2 weeks and I want it too. I'm like, well, we're sending patients home same day now. They're like, that's nice. I want to go home. You know, I want to go to a rehab facility. So the fact that we, I would say, for lack of a better term, change the messaging. Saying patients, it's safe to go home. This is what we do. This is how we take care of you. This is how you're watched out for. And we reduce all those post-acute care costs. And then, for example, you know, rehospitalizations or emergency room visits. Like, do you really need to visit an emergency room because your wound hurts a little bit? No, you don't. You know, come into clinic, see us, or give us a call. And we can talk about things like that. So I think we became more savvy doctors. Prior to that, we didn't have a gun to our heads. So we did make changes. And the study basically said, congratulations, you made the changes. So will that mean it's going to be
achievement unlocked?
Next, you leveled up. Actually, they leveled down because by making the lower level of money, then you said, oh, so you save money. We're going to make you save even more. So not leveling up, leveling down. But it's what we were told to do. And surgeons are good at following instructions. So to some degree. So we followed instructions.
And I have to stop giving away the talking points from my methodology classes. Otherwise, people are going to stop signing up for them.
I'm going to sign myself. Great. All right.
Big finish. We're going to have to go fast.
All right. Halter traction for the treatment of axial-anterior rotator fixation, Young et al. Talk to me.
So this is a study. It's got 43 patients. Basically, their level 4 retrospective discourse on their experience in managing these kinds of cases with halter traction. I think, you know, the real question is, can you apply this to your practice? And I think one of the really important points to consider is that the mean duration of in-hospital traction was about 18 days. I can't imagine having somebody in the hospital in our clinical context where we're working for 18 days in traction.
I don't want to be there for 18 days in traction.
So that, I mean, that is definitely a question in terms of clinical application. Also, no neurologic deficits. no major complications. Everyone did great. And that, I'm always suspicious of reports with that kind of thing. I'm not necessarily saying that that wasn't their experience, but it's just that you would never expect any kind of treatment to have 100% great outcomes 100% of the time. So when you're seeing that kind of thing, that's what we call restricted clinical variation. And it means it may not be replicable and their experience may not be reproducible in other hands, in other clinical contexts.
But they're from Taiwan, so they're perfect. That's what I have to say from my cultural background.
Fair enough. An epidemic amidst a pandemic, musculoskeletal firearm injuries during COVID-19. This is from Inclan et al. And it's open access.
A morbid topic, but it's an important one that they needed to address and take a look at. So the only thing I would say, if they were querying a database and they were looking at certain words like gun or gunshot, I know they have a trauma database, but it would have been nice to look across an EMR and say, why don't we get everyone who's come in? Again, they did plastic surgery, spine surgery, were with, you know, plastic surgery and neurosurgery with other ones. So, you know, the take-home message was interesting. You know, there were more gunshot wounds during the pandemic, which is, you know, something that I don't think we all think of on a regular basis. So it was interesting just because they were given that there was less interactions with individuals, more people were staying at home, more people were being inside, right? And there were still more gunshot wounds. What was interesting that I didn't really talk about and elucidate is there were less assaults during the pandemic, but more self-inflicted injuries. And they didn't tease that out during the discussion, which is a really tough topic. And I think it really speaks to the mental health impact of COVID on individuals that I wish they teased it and talked a little bit more. The follow-up was interesting. You know, I think it would have been fine just leaving it as just a firearm only study. They looked at the follow-up and found out the follow-up was similar, there were more uninsured people getting firearm assaults, but less of them following up postoperatively in clinic, which is, you know, they did capture more patients, which is good to know and see that. One of those things from a public health perspective, one, we should address this head on and say, be careful of firearms, especially during these pandemics, especially if they're at home and, you know, people are in danger, especially self-inflicted injuries. And on top of it, how can we reach out to individuals who've had these firearms who are uninsured and should be following up? So how do we get to these and speak to these individuals more, you know, reach out to them? So, you know, multiple different areas, especially in the pandemic, we're hoping that this is it, but we know there will be other pandemics. And how can we take the lessons here and apply these further on in orthopedics? You know, a lot of time in orthopedics, we're like, hands off during a pandemic. We're not infectious disease. We're not that, but we actually can have an impact on patients and not just their musculoskeletal care, but these trauma situations as well. All right. Tell me about epidemiology, your specialty, and methodology, treatment and qualities of overriding distal metaphyseal radial fractures in children and adolescents. And this is by Lacassin et al. And there's a commentary on this as well.
So this is kind of like the Halter Traction article, but now we're talking about distal metaphyseal radial fractures in children and adolescents. This had 113 fractures in 112 patients, basically getting the Helsinki New Children's Hospital experience. Really good outcomes, even in the case where they leave the fracture position overriding. I think this is reinforcing some of the tenets that have been out there in the pediatric orthopedic literature. It's an interesting clinical experience, appropriately graded as level 4. Again, you know, whether or not the children, adolescents, or their guardians would provide the same ratings with the same clinical outcome in that context versus Boston, Massachusetts, or anywhere else in America is something that's open to question. Certainly, they are pointing out viable treatment approaches for these types of injuries, and some of which minimize the discomfort and the distress of children, which I think is overwhelmingly important. So interesting work. If you don't want to take our word for it, check out the commentary too.
Other people's voices are also important and good to hear.
That's it. We're out of time, unfortunately. Hoping that you're in the middle of that workout or that your commute has come to an end, or maybe anesthesia is calling saying your case is ready to go, but we're here. This is still, your case is on hold.
Thank you for being in, and thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.